Hello and welcome to episode 182 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and Ed Qualtrough. It seems that the frozen wastes of February might be receding into the horizon, and we are blessed once more with warmth and the temptation of spring. Chris, how are you?
Well, I'm very well, thank you, Matt. It has been a transformation, I have to say. It's done my mood no harm at all. The fact that I could go outside today in a t-shirt and not be instantly rendered immobile by the biting cold. A bit of sunshine, mild temperatures, it makes a hell of a difference. And yeah, pretty well, you know, all things considered, it's been another week of fairly humdrum week in many ways. Nothing to report really on the work front. It's been plugging away at the usual, but every week swings something a little more different, a different question, a baffling answer, you know, all of that kind of thing goes on. But yeah, it's not too bad.
Any questions you can actually remember?
Oh, many questions I can remember about people and ERP systems and cloud migration and about how, you know, people are going to go back to the workplace. I'm not going to use the return to work thing because we've all been at work, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's not a return to work at all. So lots of the usual, I think, you know the kind of questions you'd expect around now. But, you know, client confidentiality forbids. Mark, you know that, how this works.
Wonderful. And then a guest on the show this week, Ed, absolute delight to have you with us. How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you both. It's a pleasure to pseudo-see you. It's been a while. How am I? I'm as well as you can be, I think. I think I'm in one of the luckiest brackets in that I'm healthy and employed like yourselves. I can work remotely. I'm lucky in the sense that I don't have to do child education from home. So that's a benefit. And I think we're in a lucky industry. If I look out of the window, and sometimes it's been a sort of slightly scary outside world in the last 10 months, that I think the tech/digital/IT function has been incredibly robust. And I'm probably lucky to be in a part of the media organization that covers it. So for people who don't know, I used to work with Matt and Chris. Not that we had the same employers, but I was the editor of CIO UK or CIO magazine. And I started a new role in March 2020. So the 16th of March, which was the first day that the UK was told to work remotely for New Statesman Media Group, which is it's been a fun, what are we coming up to, 11 months.
Yeah, that's an interesting time to change employer and try to be able to find your feet in a new role with. Have you actually managed to be in an office at any point in that 11 months?
I went in on the first morning. I was told the weekend prior to joining that I'd go in, but they'd already asked everyone to work remotely. So like a load of organizations, I think they were already a step ahead of the government, which a lot of people have been over the last year. So I went in the morning and I picked up a laptop and then I returned home at lunchtime. So that was the last time I got a Pret sandwich at lunch. There are other sandwich manufacturers and retailers. And I also went in September. So I share a one-bed flat in southwest London with my partner, and we both had some, I suppose, recording/hosting responsibilities at the same time that probably couldn't be done if one person was sort of removed to the bathroom or something along those lines. So I had to host an event for the Labour Party conference, which took place virtually. So I went in the office, which I quite enjoyed. You know, what I like about the office was getting on my bike and riding into town. But it was quite a sad experience as well, because I was the only person there. I was up in the fifth floor boardroom. I was the only person in there all day. So that was a little bit sad. They'd even taken the courtesy of putting a sign saying that I'd booked it for the 1 hour slot when I had it, but there wasn't a single other soul in there from 9 till 5. So that's been my two trips into London, into the office in inverted commas. That was a little bit too visual for podcast thing, the bunny rabbit ears. I did.
We can do a voiceover. We can have this as a vocally assisted.
Yeah, that's right. Audio description. We need audio description to go alongside.
Maybe that's the way forward for this. Yeah. I'm sure we could sell that as a concept to somebody in the Valley, and it will be audio described podcast. Wow, man.
Just got to think future. Of a name. Think of a cool name and a URL, and we'll be away.
We'll be there. Absolutely. Yeah, the experience of going into an office during this, I think I've managed about half a day, and it's very odd being in a space that usually you'd associate being with people. And I think now, I can't remember the last time I went in, it was months and months ago. I do think now, I do have this sense that I might be becoming a misanthropic hermit, and that actually at the end of this, I won't leave the house anyway, just because why would one? And I don't know, watching stuff on TV where you've got people close to each other just looks really odd now. Very strange. I think it's going to take a while to be able to get back into thinking about what these spaces might be used for.
Well, it's good that your misanthropy is being usefully employed. You know, as a hermit, it's a bit more in character of a hermit, isn't it? I haven't been to an office. In fact, last week I was starting to lose it a little bit with being in my little cubbyhole here. I've been here far, far too long and not been anywhere else. And, you know, I don't have an office to go to. We do have one in London, but why would I go to London? There's no need for me to go down there. So, yeah, it's a bit grim. Anyway, come on, Matt, what have you been up to?
I have been, work stuff. I have just about finished a book called The Happiness Industry, which I found a fascinating read, all about the stems of... Actually, it's another book, a bit like a book that was written about 20 years ago called The Tyranny of Numbers, that talks about some of the challenges that we have from being obsessed about measuring things. And it stems it back to Jeremy Bentham, who by all reports was a genius, but also somewhat unhinged, through the Chicago School, through Taylor, that's not necessarily in the right order, and all the way to the modern day, and things like employee engagement movements and things. It's a really, really good book. I thoroughly recommend it. I visited to the scene of the Thames freezing over at the weekend, which quite frankly, it's just up the road from where I live. And it was a little bit overplayed if you did see media reports about how the Thames was freezing over and we were on the verge of another frost fair or something. And actually, it was just a little bit cold around the lock at Teddington, which isn't really technically the free-flowing Thames. But on the same day, saw a seal bobbing around in Teddington Lock. So that made my weekend much happier. And then Watford seemed to have pulled their finger out and had a performance for the first time in what seems like months. So all in all, it was a very good weekend. And with half term this week, I've got a 12-hour week. I know Julia last week was talking about the 4-hour week. I'm doing three times that, but I'll be doing 12-hour weeks, see what I can achieve in the space of a day and a half. And then I will be trying to find things to do with my children for the rest of the week to keep them and me entertained without us wanting to resort to computer games or violence. So we will see how that goes. I'm sure it will all end splendidly, but it feels a little bit daunting just at this point in time. So this week we're going to talk around some of the things that Ed is doing at the moment. We're going to talk a bit about where the sort of tech leadership world is at the moment in coming out of lockdown, if that ever happens. And so let's press on.
So Ed, as you said, you've changed your job. You're now deeply ensconced within New Statesman, and you've got this tech monitor malarkey going on. What's all that about?
What's that all about? All sorts. So New Statesman Media Group has launched a whole series of titles, which they launched in October 2020, of which one of them is called Tech Monitor, which very, very broadly is covering, I'm going to do those bunny rabbit ears again, digital transformation or disruption and whatever that means for organizations and the people who are leading that change. So it's a new title. It's been launched relatively quietly, I would guess, in the sense that when a lot of startups, media startups, and I'd say, I don't know if you followed this, Andrew Neil and GB News, you know, they always launch with some very grandiose statements about how they're, to go back to that word, they're transforming everything that they're doing. And it's rarely that new or innovative. They just have a load of foghorns on the radio talking about rubbish. I think what the New Statesman's investments in their new titles are just to invest in editorial and try and do something sincerely and try and do it quite well. So it's one of the biggest editorial teams I've probably worked with. There's about eight of us. So we've got an editor-in-chief called Pete Swaby, who came over from the Economist Intelligence Network. I've got this sort of vanity title that's deliberately vague. which is I'm the technology editor for New Statesman Media Group. I'm the special projects editor for Tech Monitor. So I dabble in a bit of research, a bit of rankings, editorials, CIO, CTO interviews, that sort of thing. We've got these incredibly bright young data journalists. So one thing I think that you would notice if you went on Tech Monitor, and the URL is techmonitor.ai, I wouldn't read too much into the AI if I were you.
.com wasn't available. I think what we'll read into that.
Possibly. No comment. Is that data is I wouldn't say it's at the heart of everything we're doing, but we've got these bright young things who are producing incredibly, you know, visual, graphic, really insightful articles. And it's that really refreshing and engaged place to be. So it's been very exciting. And we've got these sister titles that launch at the same time. So we've got a sister title called Energy Monitor, which is all about being inside the clean energy transition. We have a title about cities, which is the impacts of policy and tech and energy and everything on like the urban environment. And Investment Monitor, which is all about something called FDI, foreign direct investment, which I won't pretend to know absolutely anything about. So those titles launched in October. We all work together and collaborate as well every now and then. So part of the idea of the New Statesman Media Group launching this new suite of titles, and they are at a sort of arm's length in the sense these are fundamentally, you know, they're closer to being business titles than they are to being consumer titles. You won't read an iPad review on any of them. Is that tech is embedded throughout those other ones as well. Tech is no longer a vertical. Is that the right one? Not horizontal? Yes. Tech is no longer a vertical that should just live completely in its own niche. And that needs to be embedded in the energy title, in the cities title, in investment. And I think they may or may not be launching more as well that I may or may not be allowed to talk about. So one of the collaborations that's happening at the moment, for example, is, you know, every month we have a series where we all cover the same topic. So last month it was the Biden transition and what that means for those different sectors. So I actually spoke to two former federal CIOs last month, which was really insightful. I spoke to Tony Scott, who was the CIO under President Obama. And I spoke to a man called Stephen Van Roerkel, who was also a CIO under Obama. And he became the COO, the de facto COO of the US government, actually, before he went on to go and lead the Ebola response in West Africa as the chief innovation officer. So he had some really interesting things to say about tech leadership in government and data setting you free, which is one of his phrases, about battling disinformation, which is something they had to do in West Africa when they were tackling the Ebola response. So it's interesting to see how these things are, you know, come back round. And this month, though, the Tech Monitor title that I work for is the lead monitor in the subject we're all covering, which is about the big tech backlash. So if you go on Tech Monitor, Energy Monitor, City Monitor, you'll find all articles about the big tech backlash and what that means. It's very loosely defined, but we've got a article by our data journalists and the New Statesman data team, which is about, it's a lobbying index of big tech and how much money they've spent getting in front of US politicians. It's very interesting, specifically about what acts and US legislation they're trying to get in front of US politicians about. I've got an article that's being published on Wednesday that I look forward to finish piecing together tomorrow, which has got the title, Whatever Happened to the Platform Mutuals? I think you'll be quite interested in it, maybe, Matt, if I was to try and second guess what you may or may not be interested in. So it's a follow-on from an article that a mutual acquaintance we have called Jerry Fishenden, who was the deputy government CTO, wrote in 2015, which was called Time for the Rise of the Platform Mutuals. And it was all about the concept of why have an Uber that is privately owned when there could be one that's a cooperative in the John Lewis or the co-op model. And it's revisiting what's happened in that space in the last 5 years. And there are some interesting examples, actually. The co-op and a group called Unfound that supports and helps scale and grow some platform mutuals are, you know, making some headway with groups of farmers and organizations. And I've spoken to a few academics. So it's quite interesting, I think, to see what will happen in that space, if anything, because it's a hard area to get into.
It's an interesting area that I remember shortly after I left Microsoft, and
I wrote a blog about how Steve Ballmer was, he'd announced his departure and how he wanted to be able to do something amazing, and suggesting that maybe something amazing would be to leave by turning Microsoft into a cooperative, employee-owned partnership, which would give it a unique edge in terms of the way in which the market, Microsoft then would have a thing that would stand out from the market other than being the people who are able to industrialize everybody else's ideas, which seems to be their kind of their core strength. But there are very few, if any, examples of significantly different business ownership models within the tech industry, with the exception of it's either open source or it's proprietary. And that's it.
Exactly. And I think it will be interesting to see, you know, if any develop. I think I don't want to stick to the examples of taxis because it's too an obvious one, but why, what is holding the Bristol minicab drivers back from, you know, apart from the technical challenges of it, would consumers be more willing to pay an extra quid or two per fare on the basis that they're not being subsidized by reams and reams of venture capital cash to use the local taxi company with the money, you know, staying in the city rather than disappearing or just being burned? So I think it would be interesting to see what support, if any, these organizations get, the role that unions play, particularly if you're, I don't know, something like the London Taxi Drivers Association. You know, you must have a significant cash flow to start something, whatever that looks like. So yeah, anyway,
might be interesting actually if we see some of that sort of thing coming out of the back of the pandemic and the lockdown, because I know I was looking at a site at the weekend, which is, the UX was terrible, but it was an interesting idea, which was a platform for wholesale food producers and distributors to be able to sell directly to the consumer. So people who would traditionally sell to restaurants, so obviously that market has been absolutely decimated in the last 12 months, but can they sell their, you know, their fruit and veg or their shellfish or whatever else directly to consumers by using an aggregating platform that is the model of a, you know, a market, a physical marketplace. And from the look of it, it seemed that was being done as a cooperative venture to be able to help all the people involved rather than it just being another .com thing on top. Certainly, say the user experience of it would indicate there wasn't a lot of money being put into the top end of it.
Well, I think that is happening in Bristol. So there's a Bristol Business Association that got quite a lot of organisations on board. I think it's very similar. I think it's just run on Shopify or something quite similar at the moment. And actually, I've got an old school friend who's riding his cargo bike around Dulwich every Thursday. So he's got about 30 local, it's certainly not a platform co-op, but it's a platform business, 30 local organisations from the fruit and veg seller to the off license, and he sticks them all in his cargo bike and spends his Thursday riding around the area. I think a load of SE, so Southeast London postcodes, and a couple of SW postcodes, delivering foodstuffs on their behalf based on a tech that he's sort of built, he's put together. So
that is great, and it's nice to see. But the challenge we have, right, is that people, and we've seen that again and again, people, A, they want things to be cheap, and B, they want things to be consistent and predictable. So that's why we've got, I don't know how many people sign up for Amazon Prime, right? But a lot of people pay for Amazon Prime. I'm one of them. We've had it for a while. And why do I keep it? Probably because if I stopped it, then the TV would stop working and I'd maybe watch Amazon Prime once every 3 months or something, right? But it's nice to know it's there. And also, if I do buy things from Amazon, which I try not to do too much of, it means I don't have to worry about anything. It's all included, which I could probably, I don't know. It's one of those things that's become a part of what I pay for, and I don't question it too much. Now, the fact that Amazon has grown so quickly and grown so, and at the expense, let's face it, of the high street and of local businesses, is because people actually don't care. They really don't care. They want to pay £2 less. They don't want to pay more just because the money happens to be going to some worthy kind of nebulous idea of local. They'll vote with their pounds at the end of the day. This idea that people will say, oh, it's okay, it's staying in the locality. Well, some people will, but the majority won't. I just don't see it. And the fact is that this money is being, you know, the money to build scalable systems like Uber and whatever has been bankrolled by people who have got nothing better to do with their money. And they see something at the end of it, but I'm not quite sure what. But I hate to be the Merchant of Doom, but I just don't see it.
You are the Merchant of Doom. Very disappointed with you. I was wondering why Amazon have got all this money, because I use it once a year. And there is, that's you, Chris Weston, with your Amazon Prime account.
I'm a traitor.
Uber's business model has already tipped in the last few months to being it's making more money from food delivery than it is from people using it as a transport service, which is quite
interesting. Well, nobody's going anywhere right now, are they? Yeah. Who's getting in their taxi now? Their surge pricing will be pretty grim.
But there's a question, though, within that of the extent to which you don't need to have it as the dominant part of the market, but if you can carve out enough of it, then there's an alternative. So I think, you know, on the logic that the people don't do stuff, well, organic food wouldn't exist on that logic, because people wouldn't pay extra for stuff that hasn't had pesticides on it. Organic food does exist, and niche food providers do exist. And I think the thing about these alternative platforms would be, can you build something that has enough scale and reliability for it to be credible as an alternative as opposed to a competitor? I think Amazon have won the day. I don't think, you know, it's difficult to see Amazon going away for the next 100 years. It may well happen, but it's difficult to imagine that at the moment. But it's more about, can you provide something that is able to enable small businesses to be able to have a comparable service in a way that gives people alternatives that isn't more expensive? And, you know, there's always differentiation in markets like that.
Well, Matt, you're right. And I'm not saying that nobody will pay. There are people who will pay for organic honey or God knows what, right? And they've got various reasons for doing it. And I'm not going to go into that right now. But there are also platforms that help the smaller business, right? So, or they help them. They at least facilitate them or enable them. So Just Eat and Deliveroo and all those people, they'll come and fetch food from whoever, right? They'll if you've got a local kebab shop or a pizza house or whatever, they'll deliver from there. So there are platforms that can enable that. That's not the issue. My comment is really about this what they've done is they've been able to scale it by providing one thing, which is nationwide, and the local things, I think they're great until you try and scale them, and then they start to get a bit wobbly. But I don't know how Deliveroo and Just Eat took off. I don't know where that money came from, but I guess it's from the same old model, the same model of venture capitalists or private equity, whatever.
I think that any switch will be defined by regulation and tax. And I'm going to assume, and because I've seen it in the editorial running order, that one of my colleagues has covered this as part of the big tech backlash coverage. But I don't know what exactly they would have said. But I think that will be the area that makes the, well, I would say levels a playing field between,
which is of course why they're spending so much money on lobbying politicians to be able to stop that happening, isn't it? Exactly. The Tech Monitor and the rest of the Monitor network, there's obviously a lot of crossover in those different titles, and when you were talking about it, and I think in my own industry at the moment, then I can see that the energy one, the tech one, and the cities one are completely intertwined in the world of housing at the moment, because all of that kind of interoperates with one another. What are the audiences that you are looking to be able to get to with the titles? Who is it that you are wanting to talk to?
Very good question. So this is like the question I usually ask CIOs when I ask them, when I interview them, I ask them what their mission statement is. And if they can't do it, I have a go at them. Usually just staring disappointedly.
What, their organisational mission statement, Ed, or their personal mission statement?
Well, organisational, and one thing I was a bit of an advocate for was, should a technology function have its own mission statement, or is that irrelevant? Now, I don't want to be a politician and just pivot Matt's question over to something else. So on tech, we want to speak to the people who are shaping the, I suppose, the end user technology environment, and the people who are making, I suppose there's a business element, which is the purchasing decisions, and have the power, and we want to reach those and the levels below them who are making the change happen. But there's is sort of two-sided, because it's explaining the change to the people who are already making it. So that's what we're trying to do in tech. Energy is it's about leading the clean energy transition. So I think energy is a different area. Like, there's an intellectual and a moral battle in the energy world that's already been won, in that we know what the end point is and should look like. So they have a much more clearly defined mission of what they're trying to do. Whilst tech, we couldn't say we're trying to lead digital transformation, because it means everything and nothing and all points in between, depending on what your sector is. So the big hitters in those area, in those verticals, whether you're a city mayor or a planning chief in cities, if you're anyone in the energy sector in energy and on tech, people who are in senior tech roles, but also actually increasingly line of business and board level people. And I think actually that will be a big defining thing this year, which is, you know, it's so like trite and generic, but tech/digital/IT has just leapt so far out of the cubby hole that it was in that it's much bigger, and it needs to be, or people need to be involved in leading those decisions and those changes.
Yeah, that's, I think, something that I've thought for quite some time now, that decisions about technology are far too important now to be left to just technologists.
Absolutely, yeah.
we still have, in so many organisations, an absence of technology understanding and experience at the most senior levels, which becomes really problematic, because if you've not got... I've never been of the view that a CIO needs to be at board level by default, but I do worry where you don't have people with technology experience operating at the most senior levels within an organisation, because it's so fundamental to the decisions that most organisations have to make now.
But isn't it sometimes about the people in those roles? Not to criticise them, really, because there are some brilliant communicators in CIO roles, but somebody made a comment a few days ago in passing, and it was something like, you see a lot of CIO job descriptions or requirements for a person to be a CIO, and it's almost like saying that they want somebody to come along and be a city planner and manage massive, you know, citywide projects. And but also they must have worked as a bricklayer for the last 10 years. They really are. They want a lot of depth in technology as well as the management of it and the explanation of it and the value derivation from it. And maybe that we haven't got mature enough in our expectations of somebody who leads a technology part of the business.
And the fault of that, Chris, is you and me, on the basis that if we were to vastly oversimplify the situation here, Matt is a CIO or equivalent doing the role, and the forces are from the analysts and the media, who for the last decade and a half have just lumped more and more responsibility, I think, onto technology leaders, which went from, I suppose, sort of IT facilities management, and then all of a sudden it's, well, you also have to be a business leader, and you now also have to lead a technology transformation based around the SMAC stack, and then after that it's now digital transformation, and also it's a sort of the whole cultural transformation of your organization and the future of work, and nothing has ever gone off the agenda and the list and the job description you've described.
Guilty as charged.
It just keeps going on and on and on, and I'm guilty as charged as well, because I've written those articles saying, well, actually, what's your innovation agenda? What have you done to develop the diversity of your tech function that you inherited, that was overwhelmingly, you know, looked like one thing, and now that's going to make you crap products all of a sudden? And I think, you know, sorry, I'm being slightly flippant, but it's not that we're to blame, but I think it seems to me, as an idiot outsider looking in, it's one of those roles that has only accrued more and more, and nothing's gone. The bricklaying is still there.
It's very true. And, you know, and now when you're doing all that, now explain Kubernetes, right? And you've got to be able to do all of those things. And it's really difficult to do all of those things.
And quantum computing as well, which is going to be awesome. But then I can explain it and then not explain it all at the same time, and both are correct. It's, yeah, there was, I think it might have been Don Tapscott, maybe somebody else actually, but a metaphor for how with energy in industrial settings, it started with the having to site yourself next to a natural source of energy, so a water wheel next to a river, and then it went to the steam engine, but still the plant needed its own source of power. And then the structure of the factory would be laid out in such a way that everything could be attached by belts and pulleys and cables and stuff to the source of power. And then Westinghouse invented the electric grid. And then the steam engine was replaced by an input for electricity. And then only after a while did people realise that you then weren't tied to having your factory floor laid out by closest to power preference for the machines, and you could actually lay it out by things like production line model. So that kind of the history of it. And that's been used in the 10, 12 years ago as being used as a metaphor to explain what would happen with the world of technology because of cloud computing. And actually, that's a really interesting point, Ed, that what's happened is that we've now got an electric steam engine that's still powering all the other stuff, and increasingly the CIO is expected to build the machines as well as the source of the power and to maintain the source of the power and maybe have some connections to the grid as well, but make sure that they're, you know, diversely routed and either into the building. And the there hasn't been the giving up of things that needs to happen. I wonder, though, if that's partly also, you know, I'm quite willing for you to take the blame for all of that. But I will, you know, step up and say, well, maybe also because the CIO in general hasn't had the ability to be able to step back and say, actually, we'll leave that part of the technology fully for somebody else to run for us. And with the exception of software as a service, which actually hasn't permeated into organizations quite as much as I think we might at first think. Certainly like utility level computing that you don't bugger around with. Hearing horror stories of an Oracle cloud implementation that I know somebody's involved with at the moment, where it sounds very much like it's nothing like the cloud whatsoever, even though it's Oracle cloud going on. There's a lot of that in other vendors as well. Oracle are not alone in that. But actually being able to give it up so that you can just allow the electricity company to provide you with the power, I think we're still quite a long way from. We've still got quite a lot of work to do that.
Dear listener, I need to tell you about the look on Chris Weston's face when Matt was talking about the Oracle Cloud implementation there. There was a definite shake of the head. I want to wind back to something you said about the way this power company was set up and where everything was. And I think that that's something that is going to happen in tech and IT and digital departments in the next year, which is almost an existential revisiting of what it is and why it's there, and its positioning in an organogram, which is nothing I've ever really considered before. But I think if something the last 11, 12 months has taught us, I think technology needs to revisit its mission and its what, if that makes any sense. Like, what's its role?
But I think actually a lot of corporate functions are going to be doing that when you suddenly break out of being in the physical office space. Maybe one of the things that will do is to lead people to think more about multifunctional teams, multidisciplinary teams a bit more, because if people aren't having to sit in the same place because you're the accounts department or the IT department or the HR department, then maybe people will start to think about that a bit more fluidly than they have before, about lumping everybody of the same profession together.
Well, you know, this might be the, you know, to take your analog of the steam engines and the pulleys and the belts, etc. This might be the point that all of that came apart in terms of the office, because we are all apart, right? But we are still connected, and we can be connected because of cloud services, cloud computing. That's what's powered this remote working capability, right? If it hadn't been invented, if we were all still working from connectivity back to an office, this wouldn't work the way it does. It would be possible, but it would be vastly constrained. So, as you say, maybe now we are all out and we're all out and about. It could come back in a different way. It could be reconstituted in a different way if we've got the courage to do it and the vision to do it. There are a lot of places, you know, a lot of people will want it to go back and reconstitute in exactly the way that it was before it broke up, but I guess it's inevitable it will change.
Not happening, is it? Absolutely not happening. The everything back as it was. And, you know, I don't want to be the particularly pessimistic, but every time the government makes a prediction about by a certain date something will happen, I think any hope around, if that's hope's the right word, around back as we were. You know, there's parts of being back in an office I quite like, but a lot of it wasn't related to work. A lot of it was related to social things. So, like I mentioned, I like riding a bicycle. So that was a commute a couple of days a week. I play squash with friends. So that was a day a week. I'd like going to pubs and restaurants, you know, and if I was to rate what I liked about offices, the work element would be quite low down the list. Now, it would be on the list, but it wouldn't be particularly high.
I wonder though, with the status quo as was, how many, if we think about our friends at Oracle, for example, how many of those actually a fundamental restructuring of organisations is actually going to be extremely painful for? I mean, how many vendors have gotten away with it for so long because of the structural setup of most organisations? How many ERP vendors have got away with it because finance teams have been very conservative and have been remained unchanged for certainly my working life? There's not been any fundamental change in the way in which accountancy is done. And whilst we're always led to believe that tech companies are people who want to be able to constantly push things forward and make things change, and it's all about disruption and transformation and yada, 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 I reckon there's quite a substantial rump of the IT industry now, which is 40 or 50 years old, and actually was quite happy with things are as they were, and was, you know, isn't particularly well geared for change.
I think the great danger is, sorry, I'm going to just jump in here. I think the great danger is that we go from being people-led decisions to data-driven decisions, right? And then I know we're all meant to be data-driven and that's meant to be the ideal. The question is, though, where does your data come from? Because if your data comes from the vendors and it comes from the industry, you're going to make a decision based on that. Now, when one thing I miss about being in the office, apart from the social things that Ed mentions, is for most of my career, I've spent my time managing teams and managing technology and affecting change and being involved in change and things like that. But influencing is really important. So if somebody is about to make a terrible decision, you can stop that happening in many ways. You don't have to necessarily come up with a reams of data to show them they're making a bad decision, because actually, that's not actually how decisions are made. You can do it in a board meeting just by the way that you close the book, the folder on your desk when they get to their decision and look at them over the desk, right? You can exert influence based on your experience and what you're trying to achieve in ways face to face and person to person and physically that you lose that influence when you come away. It's one of the things I really miss about being together in a team. Is that you lose the ability to exert your personality on what is going on. Now you may say that's a good thing and a bad thing in my case, but at the end of the day, if all we're doing is making decisions based on the numbers, then we have to be a lot more critical about where those bloody numbers are coming from. And that is a danger I see. Sorry, Ed.
So, right. So I was going to come up with another vastly oversimplified snapshot theory, which is I don't think that IT departments are as fossilized in their ways as Matt thinks.
I wasn't talking about IT departments. Okay. I was talking about IT vendors.
Oh, okay. But if they, I'll continue then, even despite that, which is I think IT departments or tech, not that I've ever worked in one, have gone through huge, huge, huge amounts of change in the way they work over probably a few decades. And I'm not sure if other departments in a lot of established organizations have probably gone through quite the same level of change that they've been through. And to extrapolate something I've been thinking about for a while, it's if we were to say that the CIO role has fundamentally changed to encompass all these other things that we spoke about before, which is no longer good enough to be a safe pair of hands as a tech leader and the bricklayer, as Chris described earlier in a way, the bricklayer with a bit of job title inflation. You need to be a bit more dynamic than that. You need to have a few more strings to your bow. And do organizations have HR leaders and finance directors and marketing maybe who have been through the same sort of evolution of the role? And then will it be a combination of tech leaders and their CXO colleagues who can actually make something happen? And I think that's a vaguely credible theory of some of my more dubious ones, which is, you know, maybe there's another podcast being recorded on the other side of the world at the moment about for HR directors, which is all about how HR directors have been through this huge evolution of the role and now they're really dynamic, and technologists and finance directors have never done anything in their lives, but I don't think that's the case. I think that those are the ones that have probably been a bit more stagnant than the way technology's moved.
Fascinating stuff. I think that's it. It's one in the eye for the other support functions. Well done, Ed, that's made me feel better about my job. We come to the end of another week's conversation. The week ahead is going to be bringing what into Mr. Qualtro's life? Do you know yet?
Oh, a lot more of the same, I think. We're just about to launch a few initiatives. So you asked about the what's on the mind of technology leaders. We're actually going to launch a research study called the Technology Leaders Agenda. So if you come back to me in a couple of months, I'll be able to tell you what everyone has responded. The theory was that these studies go every year and we're going to add our own one with the editorial of expertise of our journalists, but also we're going to get together a research steering group of a few CIOs and CTOs. So I'm working on that. And we've got an event coming up in March. We've got some great speakers from the MHRA, the Medical Research Organization. So John Quinn, you've heard it here first. You've got an exclusive. He's going to talk about the vaccine approval process and his job there. And we got the Director of Tech and Innovation from SGN. And it's just work. My week is defined by work. Speaking to some CIOs are doing some interesting stuff. So yeah, look forward to getting those rolling.
Very good. How about you, Chris?
Work-wise, I have to say, in as much as I don't remember what my calendar looks like, but it will be a bit like Ed said, much the same. I think I've got an event that I'm doing this week, which will be somewhere, I think, in Austria, which will be nice because it's always good to work with that team. I'm not going to Austria, of course, but I'll be there in spirit and virtually. And, but tomorrow is a special day in that I've got to take my car for a service, which normally would be a fairly humdrum, but because of the whole palaver around coronavirus means that it's a real song and dance just to do that. So I actually got the day off. I'm so special day off to take my car for a service. How splendid. So that's me. What about you, Matt?
Doesn't it just update its firmware over the... Over the 6G network now, Chris.
That's what it should do, shouldn't it? But I fear that given the background of this particular motor and the provider of it, I'd be extremely worried if they ever tinkered with it over the air because they'd probably break it before they made it better. So yes, good old Land Rover. Long may they continue to drop crap software onto their cars.
Matt. I want to point you, another, that's my final plug. Well, I say it's my final plug. I don't know if Matt sets me up again in a second or two. But Dr. Alison Arif, she's written an article on City Monitor, which is about the future of autonomous vehicles being incredibly boring. And essentially, the technology is migrating from the autonomous vehicles to actually just driver safety and pedestrian and things around the car safety to make the world much safer around vehicles rather than leaving them alone. And it's just the edge cases of autonomous vehicles. I mean, they're so far away from actually being out there on scale. And even if they were, would it be desirable and have the people who are developing them and pump billions of dollars into research and innovation really considered most of the edge case issues around whether they would actually be any good? Yeah,
I've said it before and I'll say it again, it's not going to happen. We're not having fleets of driverless cars on our roads, probably not until I'm retired, right? So it ain't happening, but that's sensible. That's sensible use, absolutely. Come on then, let's get to Matt. What are you doing this week, Pat? Matt,
I'm looking after my children for the next few days.
Of course you are. Need to repeat this.
Well, no, but I think we're going to see how far we can, as long as it isn't raining, because hopefully it's going to stay a bit warmer, so we're going to see how far down the Thames we can cycle, not on the Thames, but on the towpath, see if we can get as far as maybe Putney or somewhere, and just get us kind of try to make a break from the routine, which I think is what we all need to do every so often. And then above and beyond that, getting ready for shortlisting of the first tranche of applications for the big tendering exercise that we're doing. So that'll be the week after next, which is getting my head around selection criteria and grids of stuff. So that's all good fun. Anyway, well, that's a great show. Thank you very much, Ed, for joining us. It's lovely to see you. And
thank you. Yeah, you didn't mention I'm just about to put you on the spot. You're joining the steering group for our Tech Leaders Agenda article, if you're interested.
I'd be delighted to.
Split.
You know that I'm never short of an opinion. That'd be great. And next week we will be talking to I think Anthony Slumber's about property tech.
Yeah, yeah, about property and what's happening in cities and all of that kind of thing. You know, all connected with this whole city monitor piece that I just mentioned, I guess. So, yes, we'll be talking to Anthony. And then a few weeks' time, we're talking to Linda Chambers about a very similar subject around hyperlocal cities and things like that. So, yes, that whole how we live, how we work, all that kind of thing is coming up.
Also booked Matt D'Ancona,
yes,
who's going to be coming in on the 1st of March to be able to talk about his new book, which is about how innovation and identity and basically how we might be able to fix the political system, which is broken. So that should be a fascinating. I saw him talk very briefly about it on an event last night, and thoroughly looking forward to talking to Matt about his book. So with that, we wish you a happy week.
Thank you for listening to WB40. You can find WB40 on the internet at wb40podcast.com, on Twitter at wb40podcast, and on all good podcasting platforms.